fitness, nutrition, sleep, longevity, performance, fat loss, and all the keys to a life of health, happiness, and success. I'm Jed Zimmer, your host, and welcome to The Health Project. Welcome back, guys. We've got episode 18 tonight of The Health Project. Very excited to bring to you Dr. Stephen Gundry, who is a renowned heart surgeon, celebrity doctor, medical researcher, and a New York Times best-selling author. Dr. Gundry is best known for his New York Times bestseller, The Plant Paradox, which is all about the hidden dangers in food that can cause disease and weight gain. He's a leading expert on the lectin-free diet and believes that we have the ability to heal ourselves through nutrition when certain dietary obstacles are removed. Dr. Gundry is now tackling all things gut health and many of the myths surrounding healthy aging in his latest book, The Longevity Paradox, which is all about dying young at a ripe old age. We cover many facets of the microbiome tonight that are contributing to how we age, and Dr. Gundry certainly gives it to us straight. If you're someone who enjoys peanuts, cashews, raw beans or chia seeds, or you're sick and tired of being sick, lethargic, and you want to do everything you can to prevent disease, and in particular with coronavirus going at the moment, this episode is certainly one to not miss. Before jumping into the chat with Dr. Gundry, guys, which is going to be a ripper, it is now time to answer a question, which is something that, again, I'm very humbled and grateful for that you guys are taking the time to shoot in a question or two throughout the week. It just does show that how important health and wellness is to all you guys out there. So very happy that a question relating something that I'm very passionate about, and that's mental health, we're setting this week. So big thanks to Hayley who sent this one in. So Hayley said, "Hey Jed, absolutely loving what you're doing and the content you're producing. It's incredibly inspiring. I see you're quite open about your mental health journey and some struggles that you've faced throughout your childhood. Just wondering if you could give off some advice for times of adversity, and what would you recommend to someone who is struggling?" Hayley, great question, and thank you very much for sending this in. It is a topic that's incredibly important, and we do need to focus a lot of our attention to it. So obviously for me, which a lot of my listeners will be aware of, mental health is something that it's been a part of a journey of mine, and something that I've dealt and overcome through my teenage years. But something to always remember is that there's going to be times of adversity all throughout our life. I know it's a question that I get asked a lot of the time if I go give a presentation to a school, or even when I'm through the office at Headspace, whatever it might be. A lot of kids might come to me and go, "Gee, Jed, how were you able to come, anxiety, and how come you're never stressed and all that anymore?" And I think that's just a false reality, because especially when it comes to, anxiety and stress, there's going to be times all throughout our life where these things are apparent. It's just unavoidable. So the advice I love to give is that it's about building, I call, a toolbox, and that toolbox are some strategies that are going to be able to help you overcome those challenging times, which, as I've just said, are going to be there for anyone regardless of what stage of their life with, because there is work commitments, there's sport commitments, health commitments, family, whatever it might be. So for me, and the things I like to advise, this is basically just my toolbox that have been able to help me overcome those challenging times, and something that I still tinker with to this day. So the three big ones, which again I have been quite open about through the Instagram page and whatnot, gratitude, empathy, and mindfulness. So they're three practices that I think just about anyone should be practicing, regardless if you are struggling, going through a stressful time, whatever it might be. I think everyone has the ability to incorporate these three daily practices into their routine. So for me, what that looks like, the first thing I do every single morning is ask myself, what am I grateful for that coming day? I keep things very, very simple with that, because a lot of people can fall into the trap of, writing down the same things each day. So I really, really try and think about what I've got coming up that upcoming day, which is pretty awesome, and something that I really should be grateful for. So I always incorporate gratitude at the beginning of the day, and then I also incorporate it at little stages throughout the day. So I know if I'm at work or whatever I might be doing, I might be exercising and I just feel myself feeling a little bit sluggish or whatever it might be. It might not even be that. I might be feeling completely normal, but I'll stop and reflect for about 10, 15 seconds and go, gee, how good's this? I've got the ability to work today. I've got the ability to, be in a gym, which is something that in a country that we're in, we shouldn't take for granted, because, you know, some people would do everything they can to be in our position. So I like to just have little moments like that throughout the day, and then I always end the day on a positive note of gratitude as well. So I ask myself, and when I say I ask myself, I do write it down, which I think is even more powerful, and I'll write down what was I grateful for that day. So gratitude, that's a big one that can really change your mindset. Empathy, another one that I've been quite open about. Always go out of your way to help others and make people, you know, make people happier, because what you'll find is by making others happier, you'll feel happy yourself. So whenever I notice myself feeling stressed or a little bit upset and down myself, I'll take it upon myself to go out of my way and send a nice message or clean the house, or for my parents if that's the case, or whatever it might be, just doing something nice for someone else, and you actually instantly feel that you feel better yourself. So it's a win-win, and I think that's, you know, something that we can really start to implement more, because it only sort of takes 10 seconds to send a quick message, or, you know, 5 seconds to let someone in traffic when you necessarily didn't have to, just little things like that. And if we all do them, it'll be incredible to see, you know, the world change in the right direction. And then lastly, mindfulness is another awesome strategy that everyone should implement, especially if you are going through some stressful times, because it really does have you stop and really just think about that present moment. So when people think of mindfulness, a lot of the time they think of meditation, which is something that I do love. I do 2 meditation sessions a day, 1 in the morning, 1 in the night, and they are both 10-minute sessions. The reason they are 10 minutes, it just sort of seems to be the sweet spot for me. I have gone to, you know, 15 to 20 minute sessions, but what I'll find is my brain sort of does tinker off a little bit, and any shorter than 10 minutes I don't seem to quite see the benefit. So I like to incorporate meditation. It's really important when you do think of meditation that, you know, again, it goes back to a lot of presentations I've given. I've had kids come up to me and they go, I know meditation's great, but every time I do it, I can feel my my thoughts just wandering off until, you know, things I've got to do that night or sport or whatever it might be, and then they say they get really frustrated, so they stop the meditation. And this is something that I've gone through as well, until I sort of came to a moment within myself, and I realized that, you know, the key about meditation is not actually the ability to clear all these thoughts, because we're always going to have thoughts coming in. It's more so about the ability to focus on what's important, and in the moment of meditation, generally speaking, and that's the breath. So, and that goes with everything in life. So when it's good to incorporate mindfulness practices, it's not necessarily about clearing all thoughts from, you know, from the head. It's more so just about focusing on that present moment and what's actually important. So I love to incorporate those 3 practices throughout the day. Outside of that, I like to also add in any form of resilience that I can get into throughout the day. And my belief with this is that's going to put me in better stead for stressful times that do arise. So little things like I love to have a cold shower. I like to exercise to that ability that's sort of uncomfortable. Heat stress, so I love using a sauna. Little things like that where you can add a bit of resilience in that is not necessarily comfortable, but it's not putting you in a too stressful position, obviously, because the aim is to reduce stress. So if we're, you know, having a 10-minute cold shower or an hour-long sauna or 2-hour-long exercise session, that's going to be completely going against what we're trying to achieve here, and that's reducing as much stress as possible. So try and add in as many little short bursts of, you know, resilience practices throughout the day will also hold you in good stead. Outside of that, I think it's really just important to reach out if you are struggling, and, you know, always know that there is someone out there who is willing to support you, and you'll be shocked and amazed by the amount of support and the amount of people that do care about each and every single person. So if you are struggling, make sure you do reach out, guys, and you know, that's always the best thing you can do. So Hayley, great question, and I really appreciate you sending in. So that's just a few practices that I love, but as I said, it's all about developing a toolbox that's going to work for you in those stressful times. And that toolbox is going to be different for each person. So the gratitude, the empathy, mindfulness, and getting some resilience in throughout the day, they're just the main 4 things that seem to work for me. But whatever's going to work for you, it's about recognizing that, experimenting, and then bringing them on in times of stressful situations. So enough for me, guys. Here's the chat with Dr. Gundry, and I really hope you guys enjoy it. Well, Dr. Gundry, pleasure to have you on, and thanks very much for joining me. And Obviously, we're in some crazy times back here in Australia and in Melbourne, specifically where I live. We've actually just gone down into we're in lockdown a little bit again. And I want to ask, how's things on your end? Over, obviously, in America, in Palm Springs, where's the situation with you guys at the moment?
Well, California, where I live, did a pretty extensive lockdown early, and we actually beat things really quite well. But then, unfortunately, I think we opened up too early, right around our Memorial Day, beginning of June, and we definitely had a big spike in really all of California. So we've locked down. The only way you can eat outside is, or eat at a restaurant is outside. All the bars are closed. Shops, you obviously have to wear a mask in California. And we're better now, but we still haven't loosened up. We obviously opened up too early.
That's sort of where I want to begin with things. It's a surreal time. It's a strange time. I want to ask, it is a very political question, but do you think the situation, do you think it's been handled well? Do you think the lockdown restrictions are the best way to go about it?
Well, I think if you look at the countries that are now pretty much back to normal, like Italy or Germany, where the lockdown was, severe, and even Canada, I have colleagues in Canada, when they could go out once a week out of their homes for an hour to get groceries or other essentials, and they were actually tracked by their cell phones. And if the cell phone didn't move, then they figured they'd come knocking on the door and figure you had left the cell phone at home and actually tried to get away without it. And that's pretty draconian, but it certainly worked. And, I talked to friends in Italy and Germany who are back at the beaches, back really having a normal life. And so far, they really haven't spiked very much. Mm-hmm. And I think New Zealand, in your neck of the woods, did it very well. They are having a few cases, but it's absolutely nothing like is happening here in the United States or Brazil, where we lead the world, unfortunately.
And when do you think we'll start to see, a trend and a move moving in the right direction? Is it a matter of, are we simply buying time until we do get that vaccine now? Or do you think, herd immunity can play a role in this?
Well, if herd immunity was going to work, then it should have worked in Sweden. And it clearly did not work in Sweden. My worry about the vaccine is... I'm a transplant immunologist by training, and part of the problem with the immune system is the immune system, the older we get, the less able it is to respond appropriately to stimuli. So, for instance, in the United States, last year's data from the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, for the flu vaccine, showed that only 16% of seniors 65 and over who got the flu vaccine had a benefit and were protected. That means 84% of people who got the vaccine still got the flu. Yeah. And if that carries true with, and the flu vaccine is well studied, if that carries true to a coronavirus vaccine, which is being pushed out rapidly, I'm afraid that the same thing will happen. And that is, the people who probably need it most are the seniors who will probably get the least benefit from it, unfortunately.
So when it comes to improving the immune system then, is that the best approach that you think everyone should be taking now? We should be trying to do everything we can to strengthen our immune system and prevent us from, prevent us not just from coronavirus, but all virus.
Yeah. And I think we really should view this as a battle, and we have to arm ourselves as best we can. And there's now, for instance, there's now five human studies that have shown that the higher your vitamin D level is, the more protected you are against getting COVID. And if you get it, the less severe it will be. Mm-hmm. So, and you have five different studies now, and it's actually quite striking, the difference. So that's one thing. And 80% of my patients, when I first see them in Southern California, which is sunny like, you know, Melbourne, have vitamin D deficiency. And that's because, you know, we're told to wear sunscreen, we're told to not get out in the sun. And so we really don't get any benefit from sunlight exposure. Mm. So, and that's the case for my autoimmune patients. They have profoundly low vitamin D. So that's one thing we can do. The second thing that I talk about on my podcasts on COVID is we have to realize that our immune system is suppressed when we're exposed to sugar. And sugar suppresses our immune system in two ways. Number one, it glucose competes with vitamin C for concentration in white blood cells. And most people don't know that white blood cells concentrate vitamin C 50 times higher than the vitamin C level in the blood. And most people don't know that vitamin C is actually normally formed from glucose by all other animals except a few of us who don't have the final enzyme to make vitamin C. So vitamin C competes with glucose for entry into the cell. And the higher your glucose level is, the less vitamin C gets into your cell. Okay. There's been additional studies, sadly, that glucose levels in the blood suppress the activity of the ability of white blood cells to eat bacteria or viruses. In fact, sadly, a nice glass of orange juice will suppress that ability for up to 5 hours after you drink that glass of orange juice in an attempt to be healthy. So I like people to have timed release vitamin C, and I like them to get about 1,000 milligrams twice a day, because unfortunately vitamin C is water soluble and it leaves our bloodstream really after 2 to 3 hours. So you have to constantly refresh it or take time release vitamin C. And then there's other things we can do. I'm a big fan of about 30 milligrams of zinc. If you can get the wafer forms that dissolve in your mouth, you're probably better off, but just get some zinc. I like a plant compound called quercetin, sometimes pronounced quercetin, which is present in the white pith of citrus. It's in apples and onions, but you can take it as a capsule. And so those are, there's another compound called selenium. A study out of China showed that people who lived in soils that had a lot of selenium had much less COVID than soils that were depleted in selenium. And my little trick is you can get enough selenium in 3 Brazil nuts a day. And that's all you need. So those are some of the tricks.
It's very interesting that the glucose and the vitamin C that you touched on, because, you know, I've grown up in that sort of myth that when you are starting to catch a cold, you should have as much fruit as possible. You should be drinking orange juice, having an orange, some an apple, because they're the highest foods in vitamin C. But it's very, that goes against sort of what you're saying there. So are you recommending to remove all carbohydrates from the diet?
No, not necessarily. You don't have to be in a ketogenic diet, but you do have to be cognizant that concentrated sources of sugar, like, for instance, the last thing you want to do to combat this virus is to have a bagel or a bowl of cereal for breakfast or a glass of orange juice, which is kind of the typical American breakfast and often Australian breakfast. So it's counterintuitive, but all the studies really do show, sadly, that sugar suppresses the immune system.
What about fruit? Obviously, fruit is going to spike insulin. It is a carbohydrate, and some fruits more so than others can a high fast absorbing carbohydrates. Does fruit have a place in the diet then, do you think?
Well, you know, in my first book, I said give fruit the boot, and I often take a lot of grief from that. The polyphenols in fruit are fantastic, but unfortunately, fruit has been bred for sugar content and size. And for instance, the highest of sugar content of any fruit is in grapes. That's followed right behind by bananas, and that's followed right behind by apples. And so, there's 25, 22 grams of fructose in a cup of grapes. And I've met very few people that can stop themselves at a cup of grapes. Yeah. And so if you want to know how much sugar that is, there's 4 grams of carbohydrates per teaspoon of sugar. So a cup of grapes is approximately 6 teaspoons of sugar. And I don't hear a lot of recommendations for people to eat 6 teaspoons of sugar as a healthy snack.
Mm. Are you recommending any other methods or protocols to reduce insulin sensitivity across the day?
Yeah, I've got a new book coming out right after the first of the year called The Energy Paradox. And one of the things I've found now, seeing patients every 3 months for the last 20 plus years and looking at their blood work, is that the vast majority of Americans and Westerners, including Australia, don't have what's called metabolic flexibility. They have insulin resistance. Normally, in a 24-hour cycle, we should be able to switch on a dime between burning glucose for fuel, carbohydrates for fuel, and then switching to burning free fatty acids, fat, and ketones as fuel. And the vast majority of people have lost that ability because we number one, the average American actually now consumes food for up to 16 hours per day. And that means 8 hours a day we're not eating, but 16 hours a day we are eating something. And we've kind of been taught that we should, you know, snack and have, you know, 3 meals a day. And that's really horrible advice to have metabolic flexibility. So how you can get metabolic flexibility is really, you know, the subject of the book. But two things. Number one, limiting carbohydrates in the diet is certainly a good place to start. They don't have to be eliminated. For instance, raspberries and blackberries and strawberries are some of the lowest fructose containing fruits. Interestingly, that hero of fruit, blueberries, has unfortunately been bred for sugar content. And now the blueberries actually have quite a bit of sugar, whereas they never used to. Yeah. So the other thing is the shorter the time period that you eat during the day, and some people call it time-restricted eating, time-restricted feeding. I like time-controlled eating. If we can diminish that eating window down to 8 or even 6 hours a day, you can rapidly get to metabolic flexibility. And my good friend, Dr. Dale Bredesen, who wrote The End of Alzheimer's, just published today his new book, The End of Alzheimer's Program. And he and I both agree that at the very minimum, you should only eat 12 hours a day, and you should give a bare minimum of stopping eating 3 hours before you go to sleep. And I've written about this in The Longevity Paradox, my book as well, where we really have to clean out our brain every night of debris. And that happens during deep sleep. And if you eat too close to bed, you will not get this brain cleaning that you need.
So obviously intermittent fasting and time restricted feeding, it's quite well known. It's a very popular topic, as you've just touched on a little bit there. I want to ask, is it with the timing of things, is it how beneficial is it to go that extra distance as opposed to, say, for instance, 12 hours as opposed to 16 hours and 16 hours opposed to 18 hours? Those little differences, do they make much of a difference?
Well, there's actually been studies looking at those differences. And the studies show that the sweet spot, if you can get to it, is a six-hour feeding window. There has been a study in humans that shows there's no additional benefit by constricting that eating window to 4 hours. As you know, if you've read any of my books, I was actually, to my knowledge, the first person to publish a book about time-restricted feeding. In my first book, Dr. Gundry's Diet Evolution, even back then in 2006, during the winter America's winter, from January through June, I ate all my calories only in a two-hour window, so that only 22 hours a day I was fasting and I was eating 2 hours a day. And that's sometimes called the EMAD, E-O-M-A-D, eat one meal a day diet. And so I published that back in 2006. And that was long before the 5-2 diet and long before Jason Fung started talking about fasting. I've done that now. This is my 18th year of doing that. Do people need to do that? No. But the time window is very important. So if people can get to a six-hour window, that would be great. But even if we could get most people to a 10-hour window, it would be so much better than what's happening with most folks right now.
Can the timing of the time-restricted feeding be more beneficial than other times? For instance, I know for myself, I like to have that intermittent fast in the morning and I sort of won't eat until around lunchtime, whereas others might actually like to eat very first thing in the morning, but then they'll have their last meal around sort of 5 or 6 p.m. and get majority of their fast throughout the evening and during sleep. Is there benefits for when you sort of do this time-restricted feeding?
Yeah, that's actually a great question as well. And that's been evaluated, in Islam during the month of May, Ramadan. You actually practice fasting where you eat your first meal of the day before sunrise, and then you don't eat or drink until after sunset. And so this is about a 12-hour non-eating, non-drinking window. And there have been multiple studies looking at Ramadan fasts and the effect on metabolic flexibility and also on activating genes that are very protective against cancer, very protective against inflammation, very protective against aging. So I guess the point of all this is there's a lot of ways to accomplish the same thing. The reason I have proposed that skipping breakfast is the easiest thing to do is because if you look at us from an evolutionary standpoint, we did not crawl out of our caves and say, what's for breakfast? Because there, quite frankly, wasn't any breakfast. We had no storage system. So the first meal of the day was when we found something to eat. And what happens fantastic by design is about 4 o'clock in the morning, our cortisol levels go up, our adrenaline, epinephrine levels go up, and that increases our blood sugar and increases the amount of glucose in our bodies, as if our design knew full well that we would need that energy because we weren't going to be eating any. And so that's why, to me, it's most useful to skip breakfast and then start at say 10 o'clock or noon and go from there.
I want to ask, while you've just mentioned that and brought that topic up, I want to ask about coffee then, which can raise cortisol. But, you know, you've just mentioned there that your body does start to synthesize its own cortisol and energy because it is preparing to wake up and it's preparing not to have to eat food. And obviously a lot of people do wake up and they first thing they'll do is go and grab a coffee, and it's only going to raise cortisol further. Do you think this is something that you should hold off on then and or wait till sort of, you know, those cortisol levels gradually drop, or it doesn't seem to matter too much?
There's a lot of really good things to like about coffee as long as you drink it black. So I certainly start my morning with a cup of coffee, black, and then I actually switch over to different types of green tea throughout the day. And even in the summer, I don't eat breakfast and I only eat lunch on the weekends. So, but yeah, coffee is not a big problem. Coffee will raise blood sugar, and some people like to blunt that effect by cinnamon. And there's some nice studies that show that cinnamon in your coffee will blunt the effect of coffee raising blood sugar. But I don't worry about it.
Is cinnamon something that you recommend if you are going to have carbohydrates as well? I know this is something that I love to. I'm going to have some sweet potato every now and then to treat myself, or a little bit of fruit. I'll sprinkle some cinnamon to sort of to help with that intern.
Yeah, it's absolutely will help. Correct.
With the fasting, just jumping back a little bit, how often are you recommending this? Do you have to be careful of your metabolism if you are fasting 6-7 days a week? Is this going to gradually blunt your metabolism and slow it down, or is it something you need to cycle with, or how often do you actually recommend it?
I think you absolutely should cycle. And in the upcoming book, and there's actually some interesting research about this, what I like to do is people follow this program during the week and then they take the weekends off. And obviously compliance increases dramatically if you get a break, but there's actually nice data to suggest that you don't want to be in continuous ketosis. I think that's been a mistake of the keto diet in general. There's certainly no evidence that our ancestors would have ever been in chronic ketosis. I mean, can you imagine if we hit a huge, you know, ripe fruit tree, that we'd sit there and go, oh, gee, you know, that'll break our ketosis, we better not. Mm-hmm. Or if we, you know, killed a buffalo and we'd say, oh, gee, you know, I'm only going to have 4 ounces because that'll break my ketosis. Of course we wouldn't do that. And you know, we were designed for feast or famine. And actually, one of the reasons, unfortunately, man took over the world as, you know, the greatest parasite of all time, is that we, unlike most animals, have the ability to store a generous amount of fat and then live off of it for an extended period of time before we found the next, you know, trove of food. Mm. So, yeah, and we really do want to, you know, follow a circadian rhythm every 24 hours of eating and not eating, but that circadian rhythm should follow the circadian rhythms of seasons. Mm-hmm. And when we look at hunter-gatherer tribes that still exist, like the Hanzas, for instance, they cycle on seasonal basis with foods they eat. And fascinatingly, their microbiome changes dramatically by seasons. And I think we should learn that, you know, our microbiome is, of course, an integral part of us. In fact, it's probably more important to us and our brain and our longevity than any of the cells in our body. Mm. And I alluded to that in the longevity paradox, but we do a really deep dive of that in the energy paradox. So yeah, we should not chronically be in ketosis.
It's really good what you touched on there about eating in season. It's something that I'm starting to take more pride in, and I'm starting to implement it a little bit. But obviously, there'd be a lot of people out there listening right now who who wouldn't know where to start. They wouldn't know, you know, like if they'd be questioning, right, is this food in season? What's your advice and how can people sort of start to take some of these steps?
Yeah, so, you know, one of our problems is up until 50 years ago, fruit, there were no 747s bringing fruit to America or Australia in the non-fruiting season. And now, unfortunately, all of us really around the world have 365-day-a-year access to really just about any fruit we can name and at a fairly reasonable price. And I have submitted since I started doing this work that if you look at great apes only gain weight during fruit season. And believe it or not, even in the jungle, fruit ripens once a year. And the reason we're designed to do that is fruit season is a great time to store fat for the winter. And in general, winter is a time of less food, whether it was a dry season, a rainy season, a cold season. And so we would use the fructose in fruit to gain weight, just like great apes. We're just a great ape. So my advice is there's nothing evil about fruit as long as you view it as nature's candy and you eat it in season and you look at, you know, okay, what was actually available, you know, in Australia in season and go from there. And for instance, in our winters, we can get all the fruits that would normally be only in summer and fall from Chile or Argentina, and we have no business eating those fruits out of season.
That's a really, really good point there. I love it. Now, we're going to jump into the plant paradox in a minute, but before jumping into that and giving our listeners a little bit of a rundown of what that actually is, what are just some foods that spring to mind that you definitely try and limit from your diet and you recommend just about anyone should? So we've covered fruit is something that should be, you know, eaten in season. What are some other things?
Well, one of the things that about 70% of my practice is now autoimmune diseases. And what I've certainly found and published is that the vast majority of autoimmune diseases can be traced, as are other diseases, to a leaky gut. And if you had asked me 15 years ago what I thought about leaky gut, I would have told you it was pseudoscience or, you know, people in flowing robes, you know, saying crazy things. But in fact, thanks to the work of Dr. Fasano from Harvard and other people, they've proven that leaky gut, number one, is real. Number two, it's measurable. And number three, through my work and others, we know that lectins, these sticky proteins that I write about in The Plant Paradox, are a major cause of leaky gut. And so getting lectin-containing foods out of the diet is, I think, one of the first places to start in repairing leaky gut.
Just to jump in there, Dr. Gundry, can you actually explain a little bit what actually is leaky gut?
Yeah, so the lining of our gut is, in one way, a horrible design. The surface area of our intestines is the same surface area as a tennis court. So when you're watching the Australian Open, imagine that surface actually lines, is in your belly. And people look down and say, there's no way there's a tennis court in there, but in fact there is. And that surface is only one cell thick. And those cells are all actually bound together, linked arm in arm. We used to play a game, a kid's game called Red Rover, Red Rover, where we'd link cross arms and there'd be two lines of kids and you'd try to break through kind of with force running across, to break through. It's not allowed in schools anymore because it's apparently too dangerous. But so there's these cross links between these cells, and they're called tight junctions. And Dr. Fasano's work showed that lectins and gluten, happens to be a lectin, most people don't know that still, can attach to these cell walls, and they flip a switch and they make a compound called zonulin. And zonulin then attaches to another receptor, and it actually breaks the tight junctions. They break apart. And so there's a gap now between two intestinal cells. And through that gap, lectins, which are foreign proteins, can get through the wall of our gut, and pieces of bacteria and living bacteria can get through the wall of our gut. And what we're beginning, hopefully, to understand is about 70%, 80% of all our white blood cells, all of our immune system, lines the lining of our gut, is on the other side of this wall. And it's there because most of the mischief that's going to happen to us comes across the wall of our gut. And so when the gut is leaky, the immune system gets activated, and literally a war gets started. And as I write about in the Plant Paradox, one of the reasons that we store fat in our gut, in our belly, is the fact that there is a war going on, and we're actually stockpiling supplies for the war effort. And that's why so many people are shocked when they follow my program and the belly fat just falls off of them, because that war stops. And it's pretty exciting. In fact, I'll give you an example from today. We had a woman, a 42-year-old woman with two kids who flew in from North Carolina to visit me in my Santa Barbara office. And we did and she was overweight and pretty miserable, but she was told, well, you're 42 and you've got, you know, two young kids, and what do you expect? And so we did all the tests for leaky gut, and lo and behold, no surprise, she had very impressive leaky gut. And she had a lot of sensitivity to wheat and to the other gluten-containing grains like oats and rye and barley. And there is no such thing as gluten-free oats, I can assure people. And she was sensitive to numerous lectin-containing foods, notably the bean family, kidney beans, black beans, pinto beans. So we took those foods away from her. And I saw her in my clinic a couple weeks ago, and she had lost 32 pounds, and without trying, and she felt great. She's like, gee, I forgot what feeling good feels like. And so we drew another set of these leaky gut panels, and her leaky gut has dramatically subsided. It's not perfect, but almost all of the markers of her immune system being activated are now quiet, and only in 3 months. And so, you know, she said, gee, you know, no wonder I feel great. And
it's remarkable.
And so, yeah, and it isn't pseudoscience. We can measure this. And I've reported this at the American Heart Association Lifestyle and Epidemiology meetings and published the data.
You're right about one thing. So she mentioned there that, you know, she forgot what it feels like to actually feel good. And I think a lot of people in this boat, you know, they go through a lengthy amount of time where they might have some stomach issues. They might, you know, they might think diarrhea and those kind of things are normal, and it's just part of life. And even things like acne, but it's really not. Our bodies were designed to feel good. So whenever there is little things like this, it's basically our body is telling us that there's something going on in there that it's not happy with.
No, that's exactly right. We've even the commercials on TV that luckily are banned in Australia, we're told that, you know, stomach issues here, there's a pill for that. Aches and pains, there's a pill for that. We make up, we put names on diseases that didn't even exist so that we can prescribe something for it. And we're actually, Hippocrates said we were actually designed to have perfect health. And the purpose of a physician, in his mind, was to be a detective and find out what was preventing that person from having perfect health and to remove those things. And the person would heal themselves. And Hippocrates was right. Hippocrates was also right when he said all disease begins in the gut. Mm. And he didn't have the Human Microbiome Project to help him figure that out.
Yeah. So what would you recommend? Would you recommend anyone with gut issues to, so we've touched on lectins. So when you're talking about lectins, are you specifically referring to legumes, grains, beans, these kind of things?
Yeah. And the nightshade family, potatoes, eggplant, peppers, and tomatoes. Those are the big mischief makers. Also, peanuts and cashews are troublemakers. Peanuts are a legume. So, and cashews are also a bean. They're not a nut at all. So we take those out of people's diets. It's easy. It's easy to find the yes and no lists. You know, they can go to drgundry.com and get the list. And that's where we start. The other thing that I think very important is most people are vitamin D deficient. And there's some beautiful papers that show that vitamin D is essential to help the gut wall heal itself by stimulating stem cells to grow and divide. And I talk about that in the longevity paradox. So we get everybody taking more vitamin D.
Do you think, obviously it's going to differ from people to people depending on how much sunshine you do get, but necessarily do you think that vitamin D is something that a lot of people should supplement with? And can you get too much vitamin D? Is that another thing that you got to be careful of?
No, I've never seen vitamin D toxicity. I've been measuring it every 3 months in tens of thousands of patients for 20 years. Dr. Mark Hyman, a colleague of mine, has never seen vitamin D toxicity. I just don't think it exists. Maybe it occurs, but I should have seen it by now.
And in regards to the gut health, is it, you know, with the sunshine and vitamin D, does that have to be direct exposure to the gut, or is it just the skin in general?
No, and in fact, really, I've never seen anybody get their vitamin D sufficiently high with sun exposure. You have to supplement it. And for most people, 5,000 international units or 125 micrograms of vitamin D is a very good place to start. Again, I've never seen anybody vitamin D toxic. I actually, this particular woman I was talking about, we started her on 30,000 international units of vitamin D, and she now has, at that level, on our system, she went from a 30 nanogram per deciliter level, which is woefully low, to 99.5 on 30,000 international units, which is where I want her.
Now, Dr. Gundry, give us a little bit of a, can you give our listeners a little bit of a rundown about the plant paradox? So what exactly is it? I know when I read it, I was constantly fascinated. I couldn't put the book down. I loved it because we've all grown up that, you know, we were taught by our parents to eat as many plants and vegetables as we can. But when I was reading it, it just, a lot of it made sense to me, especially, you know, within 15 pages, I remember reading that some of these plants, their mechanisms, they're doing everything they can to survive. So they're producing some of these chemicals, and then our body, we're digesting some of this stuff, and it simply can ruin our gut microbiome and that. So can you just explain what exactly is a plant paradox?
Well, the paradox is, I actually believe that in a plant-centric diet, that most of the things we should be eating are plants, but we have to understand that plants do not want us to eat them. They have a life. They have an evolutionary reason to grow and to make babies, their seeds, and to protect their babies. And they were here first. They weren't put here on Earth for us to eat. They were on Earth long before any animal arrived, and the first animals were insects. And plants had a problem. They couldn't run, they couldn't hide, they couldn't fight. So they're chemists of incredible ability. And so they use biologic warfare. And one of the deterrent systems are lectins. And lectins are designed to make the predator not thrive. There's very good studies. You can inject lectins in the bellies of rats, and they will get so anxious and depressed that they will hide in the corner of their cage and not come out and look for food. And if you think about it from a plant standpoint, having a rat not looking to eat you, it would be a very good defense system. They bind to sugar molecules in our joints and cause arthritis. They bind to sugar molecules that line our blood vessels and cause heart disease. They bind to the sugar molecules in between nerves and cause neuropathy. In fact, that was the original system. They would paralyze insects. Now, to a plant, we're just a giant insect. And you know, while we might not necessarily get paralyzed, we certainly see a number of people with neuropathy and even dementia, where we get rid of these lectins and see impressive improvement. Mm.
What would be some plants that you stay clear of completely then?
Well, I think we just named them, the grain family. Beans, you can pressure cook all the troublemakers. You can pressure cook nightshades. You can peel and de-seed peppers. The peels and the seeds have the lectins. You can peel and de-seed tomatoes. So those are options. The squash family are also, the peels and seeds have lectins in them. Stay away from peanuts and cashews. Stay away from quinoa. Stay away from buckwheat. They all have impressive lectins. Stay away from chia seeds. I much prefer people eating basil seeds, and basil seeds make far better chia puddings than chia seeds. And so basil seeds are easy to come by now.
Interesting.
And yeah, it's great. So I highly recommend basil seeds.
And do basil seeds have high levels of omega-3 fatty acids as well as chia seeds?
Yeah, they do. But remember, the omega-3 fatty acids in chia seeds, two papers show that chia seeds promote inflammation despite having omega-3 fats. And that was one of the reasons I was a big fan of chia seeds until I read the literature, thanks to Lauren Cordain, who was the original founder of the paleo diet, professor at Colorado State. So just because somebody tells you something is healthy and their great-great-great-grandparents ate it may not hold true. For instance, Italians have always peeled and de-seeded their tomatoes before they make tomato sauce because they know the peels and seeds are dangerous. The Southwest American Indians always peel and de-seed their peppers before making chili powders or eating their peppers because they know the peels and seeds are dangerous and so on.
And what about the longevity paradox? Does this cover in terms of the diet side of things? Is this different to anything we've said, or if you're following the principles that you and I?
If you're following the principles, the longevity paradox is, you know, we all want to live a long time, but we just don't want to get old. And when we look around at what's happening to people as they age, we may be living longer, which is actually not true, but it appears we're living longer. But in fact, our health span is dramatically decreasing. In fact, people of the baby boom generation, my age, have far worse health than my parents' age, which shocks most people. We take far more medications. And we know that the children of baby boomers, the Gen Xs, if things continue, they will have actually a shorter lifespan than the baby boomers. And my only hope for the millennials is that you learn from our mistakes, and there's plenty of time left, but learn now.
I'm going to ask you something quite funny, actually, Dr. Gundry. I know you're quite close with Dave Asprey, who is very passionate about longevity, and he's quite open with it. He's come out and actually said he wants to live to 180. You know, for some people, this sounds absolutely ridiculous, crazy, bonkers. What do you think is actually achievable? Do you think anything over 120 is actually something that people can do if they stick to what we've discussed today?
Well, I mean, we know 120 is achievable. We have a saying in our institute that 150 is the new 100. And Dave and I laugh about this because, you know, he's going to make it to 180, but I guess I'm going to check out at 150. But I've got a little head start on him in age. So I told him I'd race him to 100, but I have a head start. So we'll see. But yeah, I think... one of my patients who I dedicated the longevity paradox to, Edith Murray, lived 2 weeks shy of her 106th birthday, and she literally was in perfect health, had all her marbles, as we say, walked around in 2-inch heels at 105, and then she went to sleep and didn't wake up. And so she was actually a follower, until she met me, of Gaylord Houser. And Gaylord Houser was a very celebrated nutritionist in the 30s and 40s and 50s, and had clinics around the globe where he'd cured himself of tuberculosis with a diet. He had tuberculosis of his hips. And so she was instrumental in actually teaching me his tricks. So yeah, I think the more we learn about how our gut microbiome probably controls how long we're going to live, applying the principles of the plant paradox and the longevity paradox and soon the energy paradox, I don't see why we can't have not only a long lifespan, but more importantly, a very long health span.
It is very interesting. Do you have a, have you set a number for yourself that is a goal, or it's completely irrelevant?
Well, no, you know, if I don't get to 150, I lose the bet with Dave.
True. You've held yourself accountable, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah, Dr. Gundry, I'm going to finish off with some questions, predominantly going back to the virus and coronavirus, which we were talking about at the start, because I chucked it up on my Instagram yesterday that I was talking to you, and I had quite a few questions that got sent in and that people wanted some questions answered. So if you don't mind, I'm going to send you shoot you through a quick fire questions.
Sure.
So one of the first ones was, what is the difference between a good virus and a bad virus?
Well, there's actually viruses that we have a viral genome in us. And there's actually a lot of viruses that kill bacteria. And early on, some of the original pharmaceutical companies actually made bacteriophages, which are viruses that kill bacteria. And for instance, a very famous drug company called Eli Lilly got their start by manufacturing and selling bacteriophages. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing necessarily bad or good about a virus, but some viruses can be very useful to us.
Is it possible, this is something that I've just thought of on the spot, is it possible to have such, you know, a strong immune system that you can reject any virus, or is that not achievable?
Well, I think it's more of a question of what you allow your immune system to do with a virus. Yes, I think it's very possible to have a very strong immune system. For instance, I've written about this. If I feel like I'm coming down with something, or I have a scratchy throat or a runny nose, I'll take 150,000 international units of vitamin D3 3 days in a row. Yeah. Literally 500,000 units of vitamin D3, and knock on wood, it snuffs out whatever that virus is. Yeah. Now, do I recommend everybody do that? No, but that's what I do. And so, yeah, I think you can fortify yourself to fight just about any virus that wants to get a hold of you.
It's a common thread, vitamin D. It seems to be, regardless of what you're after, it seems to be a common thread that this is pretty much the most important nutrient within the body.
Yep.
Now, three, so selenium, vitamin C and zinc, which we covered at the start with three nutrients that you should look to get for to prevent any virus. I want to ask, what are your three, so for each one of them, what's your favorite food source? So selenium, vitamin C and zinc.
Selenium, Brazil nuts are great. Zinc, you pretty much have to take a zinc supplement. There is zinc in cruciferous vegetables. It's not a bad source for it. And vitamin D, I'm sorry, you can bathe in the sun all day long and you just won't get a high enough vitamin D level. I wish you could, but you can't.
Lovely. And lastly, what would you actually advise? I'm not sure if you've had to deal with this much, but what would you advise to someone who's actually contracted coronavirus?
Well, so I've advised people, and one person we did put on high dose of vitamin D and had very mild course of it. I think, again, get the vitamin D up, take the vitamin C. I think quercetin and selenium and zinc and elderberry is very useful if you feel like you're coming down with it.
Yeah, awesome. Well, we'll wrap it up there, Dr. Gundry. I won't take up any longer, but awesome chatting today, and I really appreciate you jumping on board and sharing all the information. It's something that a lot of people need to hear at the moment, so a big thanks going out to you.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I hope we can do it again soon.
Absolutely. I'm sure we'll be back in touch and we'll get you back on.
Okay. All right.
Thanks, Dave.
Take care, everybody.